Since we've last talked about a month ago, kind of a difficult month regarding crime per se. We had a burglary that resulted in shots fired and then an assault rape where shots were also fired. First off, what's your reaction to how the police department and the officers handled those situations?
Beyond excellent. These are people who coincidentally, last week I swore in two new police officers just a couple of days after the most recent incident. And you know, when I swear them in, I'm swearing their families in. Their families attend the swearing-in ceremony. And it's a hard thing to talk to the families about, and then especially after an officer has just been shot at. And I think even the public might not realize, even though it was reported, I'm not sure they realize, I mean, that officer's uniform was hit by that bullet that was fired at him. And it's it's something that I think about almost every day, is the safety of those officers. I see a daily police report 7 days a week, and I know what they're facing. And what I try to tell them is I know that they've got the best training, the best equipment available to them. But what I also know is they've got the intellect and the instinct that that is needed to do the job. But especially in the most recent case, I mean, that, first of all, and I think that's true of even the officers at the police department, hearts go out to the women who were involved. Really, in my mind, they all were victimized, even the young woman who was the person making the phone call. I mean, this is just a depraved crime. And these are people who were doing what you're supposed to do and locking their house, locking their room doors, and playing it safe. And through no fault of their own, something like this happens. And all we can do is assure them and assure everyone that our police are ready to respond, they're highly trained, and will do what they have to do to keep themselves and citizens safe. But I really think those officers, I think most of us don't realize what they go through every day, but even in these specific incidents, how close this came to having an even worse conclusion, which is hard to imagine given how bad the conclusion of these crimes were.
Yeah, when an officer is forced to fire, like we've seen, are there certain protocols then that happen afterwards?
Yes, there are beforehand. I mean, they're obviously trained in when to use deadly force and how, but then also immediately, and I always feel funny about this, that they're automatically taken off duty. You know, certainly they're still being paid, but even though we're all certain they've conducted themselves completely appropriately and professionally, we have to do an internal review, and then ultimately the review is turned over to the Board of Public Safety, and the Board of Public Safety, made up of citizens, has review over those incident reports, and I am extremely confident that in all cases these officers have acted exactly the way they're trained to and appropriately, and in fact, if anything, showed amazing restraint. Another thing people may not know is that after the officer, in this case Officer Abram, fired and hit one of the suspects, he immediately then went and rendered first aid to that suspect. And I have to tell you, human nature is, I'm amazed. I'm not sure I'd have the ability to have just been shot at by someone and then end up rendering first aid to that person, but that's what they're trained to do, and that's what their instincts and intellect tell them to do, and that's what he did.
I know these are just two. It happened that within a month. Mm-hmm. Is there an increase? Are we seeing an increase of crime in the area, or is
no,
just isolated?
It's isolated, but again, that doesn't give much comfort to certainly the victims. And when you look at what happens in a community, and each case was different. We have a case where in the first case, where the people who were from the area, the other case, people who were coming in from outside the area. You know, what we've tried to do, and what the police department and all the officers themselves have done, is shift the way in which training occurs and preparation occurs. So now police are distributed differently throughout the city, and through computerization and our new ability to contact through a computer and to be able to predict where crimes are occurring, that we're able to respond much more quickly. We're certainly able to respond more effectively with the kind of training we have. We've added officers in my time as mayor. You know, we're now up to 100 officers, and it's still not the number that we should be in terms of per capita, but the number of officers isn't going to stop crime from happening. It's how we respond. And so we're really trying to put more and more effort on preventive measures. And at the same time, I don't want to give hollow promises. When we have people who come in from out of town, we can't control who's coming in. We can respond more effectively, and we can try to predict where those type of things might happen. But this is a societal problem that all communities are facing, that's the challenge that we're dealing with.
You were speaking of new technology, and I saw a report in the Herald Times about body cams.
Yes.
That's some or all of the officers are wearing?
They are.
When did those become available, and how are those being used?
Yeah, in some ways it's still experimental. We've done it for about a year, and I was a little concerned at first because I don't want the officers to feel like we feel like we need to be monitoring them all the time. They've not taken it that way. From all that I've heard from officers themselves and from our police administration, is that this is really in some ways a way to protect them, that questions get asked about use of police force, and now they have evidence. Certainly the prosecutor's office, another reason that I've mentioned technology, is that sadly, once these things have happened, a crime like this happens, the best we can do is, one, respond to them, and then also to prosecute it. And so we will now have better evidence going forward in prosecuting criminals. And so I think that they're adapting well to them. They still have some control over them in terms of when they begin taping. We aren't taping 24/7, but I think you'll start to see it more commonly used. We've had them in the cars themselves and dash cams for years, and this is just another layer of protection, really, for the officers themselves to be able to point to. We sadly do get accusations made against officers that are specious, and this is an opportunity for them to be able to prove that when it used to be one person's word against another. But I just couldn't be prouder of how the officers have responded to all of these most recent incidents.
Would those body cams ever kind of going the opposite direction become an invasion of privacy to the public?
Well, officers are responding in public, and anyone can film anyone in public. And times that they are entering into private property, it's only with cause or having been invited in. I do think that there will be a time, and maybe it's already happened, where someone might be pulled over for just a routine traffic violation, and their temper gets the best of them, and they probably don't realize and don't remember they're being filmed, recorded. Now, they always have been on the dash cam, but this is a new era we all live in, and so I don't consider it an invasion of privacy in that way. I will say, over the years, I probably have modified my thinking, but I've been an opponent of having cameras, government-owned cameras, pointed at public space. I just feel that big brotherism gone too far. At the same time, I see incidents that happen on the Beeline Trail, and you think I don't want to give people a false sense of security that cameras are watching you at all times and so you're always safe, because we aren't monitoring real time. These are videotaped things, and we can go back and review. But at the same time, it's a sad statement of societal affairs, and it's a technology that can be used for good and bad. But right now we're in that experimental phase, and I am interested in what the public's opinion is of it and what the officer's opinion is as we move forward.
You talked about during our last visit that changes were coming to the downtown parking meters and the garage use, and we had three or four Facebook comments as well. No specific questions. They just wanted to know what's the latest on the changes coming to downtown.
Yeah, I think the thing that the things, there'll be a lot of things, but I think the things people are most interested in knowing is that what I'm suggesting is that we reduce the hours of enforcement. Right now it's 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. I'm proposing we flip that 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. That way you get people who want to come to government offices or other offices and do business in downtown early in the day, have an opportunity to do it with no fee. And on the other end of the scale, people at night, you know, when you go to have breakfast or lunch in downtown, typically you're talking about an hour, maybe a little bit more stay. For dinner, typically it's going to be longer stay, but also you're looking at doing things other than dinner, other hopefully the bus chum or at the Waldron or other events. It could be you're working, volunteering at a social service agency. It could be, you know, we have the churches downtown that open their doors to so many different causes at night. And so if you come downtown at night, it typically is for longer than an hour. So I think we wanted to start with a broader policy and then work our way back. And I think we can start to do that. The other is that I think we can look at reducing the fee in the summer. And so from Memorial Day to Labor Day, I'm suggesting that we look at 50 cents an hour instead of a dollar an hour. The purpose, it's obviously been debated, and people sometimes suspect that government's doing this just for money. The purpose has always been to manage parking, and it has worked in that sense that it's increasing turnover in on-street parking, which is exactly what it's meant to do. But that need is less so in the summer months. And so I think we can afford to reduce the fee during the lesser used months of the year. The other big change that I'm suggesting is that we just go ahead and eliminate the credit card convenience fee. The purpose of having that was that allow people who are using coins to not have to pay any, you're not paying for a convenience fee. And I didn't want people who are using cash to subsidize those who are using credit cards. But honestly, that message was really never understood or made clear enough. And so it's sort of a, I hear ya, let's go ahead and eliminate that. We're also looking at creating some consistency in the garages and the lots. And so I'm suggesting 1 hour free in all the lots, the first hour free in all lots and garages, and to keep the 50 cent rate at all of those per hour and not raise the fees there.
And those, and all three garages would be consistent?
The lots and the lots. And the garages, yes.
And is there a timeline for this?
Well, it's up to the city council.
Okay.
You know, we are going to, for this holiday season, just like we did last year, Thanksgiving weekend we won't enforce at all. But this year we're adding every Saturday between Thanksgiving and New Year's so that you can come downtown and shop during the holiday season. And that's something we're just doing administratively. But all these others will require a policy, a law change by the city council.
Did you work individually with businesses or residents, or is this more just an overview of what you've heard over the past
year? Yes, and yes.
Okay.
This is what we've heard and input, but also I really credit the Chamber of Commerce has worked with us. I meet with the Chamber monthly, year-round, and we've done that for 11 years. But in this case, they've been talking to us about some of these specifics, and my thoughts are not exactly the same as the Chamber. The Chamber, for instance, is looking at hours of 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. as opposed to 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. They're concerned about people warehousing their car in the hours that aren't enforced by meters. So, you know, it's ironic that we, I'm not sure ironic is the right word, but Alanis Morissette can tell us. But I think it's ironic that we may have businesses that were concerned about the meters now are finding that they're working the way they were described, and that they might be concerned that if we don't enforce enough hours that we'll get people warehousing their car, because this will mean under my thought that you could park your car at 8 p.m. and leave it there till 10 a.m. the next day. And that's been my concern all along without meters, that people will start to warehouse their cars. And as you and I've talked about many times, with the development of downtown properties, we're about to see the loss of significant numbers of unofficial free spaces where I've always parked over the years, the old workingmen's and old, what I still call Monroe County State Bank lot, and all those O&B properties now, five properties with parking that they very graciously have allowed the public to use at night, are all going to be developed on, and new buildings, apartments, condos, hotel, restaurants are going to be built in those locations, offices, and with all the visitors, employees, tenants, we're going to we're going to see a lot bigger demand on downtown parking, which is why we did the meters when we did it, trying to get ahead of that.
I see where the I-69 Regional Summit took place downtown a few weeks ago. The evening was kind of meant to bring a whole bunch of people together to try and hop on the I-69 corridor and see the positives and what it could bring to especially the Bloomington area, a major city along the corridor. Was that encouraging for you that that's happening and that was seemed to be a big turnout?
Well, I think it's encouraging in the sense that we're now really starting to turn the corner and get in front of how we're going to handle the challenges. But on the other hand, it's also left a lot of questions unanswered. Number one, the same question I've been asking for 20 years, how is it going to be paid for? And you know, my concern is how much burden will be put on the local taxpayer, the local business community, as we start to shut down access roads and we start to see tremendous burden increase traffic load onto 2nd Street, 3rd Street, already congested even after the city built out 3rd Street. And you know, we're going to see a much greater use of those because access roads are going to be cut off. And so we'll have to build new access roads parallel to the interstate, and we'll have to adapt the existing roads that will continue to be open, Kinzer Pike, 2nd, 3rd, College Avenue exit, and somebody's got to pay for all those. And I'm worried about the congestion, but it's, again, not like other communities haven't had things like this happen before. And I also, I know I'm the only person talking about this, and it's probably an indicator that it's not as big an issue as I'm concerned about, but without an answer to how that highway is going to be paid for, and we don't even have a route yet all the way up to Indianapolis, I am concerned still about, at some point, somebody talking about toll roads. And some people might not remember this, some might, that there is a state law that prohibits tolling until you get to Monroe County. And that's still on the books. And so if there was tolling, it would start at the Monroe County border, unless that law was changed. And that concerns me. I've not heard people talking about it, but they are talking about tolling on the bridge to Kentucky, and without knowing how they're going to pay for the road, that concerns me. Also, without having identified how this is going to be paid for, I'm worried about the quality of the product that's built. We already saw under the Daniels administration, the specs were being reduced. You won't have as high quality paving and amenities along the interstate route, and I don't know what that means for us in the long run. We're also the first leg of the highway being constructed with this private contractor, as opposed to the state of Indiana doing the construction. And we're seeing what's happening with the toll road and what happened with the private contractor there. I mean, they've declared bankruptcy, and I think the state's somewhat protected, but it's a big open-ended question as to what will happen with that. And we're kind of a guinea pig in that way.
In terms of the angle of the economic development, commerce, that type of activity, what does Bloomington need to do now to prepare for that?
Well, it's been happening, and I really do want to credit NDOT for having communicated with us, even during all the different struggles that were going on, the debates about the interstate. They've always kept an open line of communication with us. The Chamber of Commerce, Jim Whitlatch, is a local attorney, chaired a steering committee of the chamber that has kept all of us in open dialogue, all of us meaning county government, city government, the private sector, the university, Bloomington Transit, and the state of Indiana and NDOT. So we've all been, and BEDC, Economic Development Corporation, so we've been communicating for years now about how to work with this. And so now I think we're starting to turn the corner and see how we're going to seize opportunities and meet challenges as they come forward. And that sounds very trite, but that's exactly what it is. It's how are we going to manage all of these open-ended questions, but also how are we going to turn this into a positive? There's no choice for those who are opposed, for those who are for. We're all in the same boat. It's happening. And how are we going to make the most of it? And in fact, I will say we've already had one company that's starting to express interest in Bloomington because they've heard about the interstate. It's an overseas company. And so, you know, we'll start to, I hope, see more opportunities come from this. That's, of course, what the proponents have always believed would happen. And we're all going to have to work together to make the best of the situation.
We did have an email from Susan. She likes to take walks around her neighborhood and wonders why that a developer is allowed by the city to build a neighborhood, collect annual homeowner fees from each household, but not maintain the trees to prune. She can't walk the sidewalks or even park without being hit by trees.
Yeah, I walk my dog every night, and there's a handful of times where I come across that. I don't live in a homeowner association situation, but I have a neighborhood association. But there are rules about keeping the sidewalks clear, and if Susan or anyone would like to contact us, call the Housing and Neighborhood Development Department, or just call 349-3406, my office, or go online or use your phone, and we have a City of Bloomington app. You can take a picture of the situation and send it to us. On a U report is the name of the service, and we'll go and work with it. There are restrictions on keeping your sidewalk and street clear. And some of the places, though, where it is a homeowner association, it is up to the association, and we don't clear the sidewalks there. And there are privately owned sidewalks and streets in the city that we all think of as being public, but there are also hybrids. There are places where the sidewalks are private, the streets are public. We have contractual agreements with some of the homeowners association to maintain them, and so it really depends where you are and what it is, but we can always go out and try to work with the neighbor to get it remedied.
In other news, Mayor Ballard from Indianapolis decided not to run mayor again. What's your reaction to that?
I identified with it completely. I have always admired Greg Ballard. I mean, he was someone who got into it for all the right reasons. I admired the fact, people may not remember, when he ran, was not the Republican Party's choice. He ran and won against the chosen candidate, and then beat an incumbent mayor, and I just feel like he's always been in it for public service. I don't know him well, but there are people, in fact, our first sustainability intern became his sustainability director, and my old dorm buddy is his head of security, and so I have a lot of connections to his administration, and we've really kind of watched him and their administration, stolen some good ideas, and I hope we've shared some things with them. But on a personal level, I really respected that he decided it had been a long time, and it was in the end the right decision for him and his wife, but I think for the city. And as I wanted to share with you, that I've made the same decision. I've decided not to run in 2015, and it's a hard decision to make. And I watched what he had to say, and I thought, I really feel like you get into this for the reasons of public service, and this community has done so much to support me over the years. I mean, but it's 12 years is a long time, and after 8 years, he felt like it had been a long time. So when I thought about it, I realized that there are only one other mayor has served more years than I have, and there's a reason for that. That it's a short shelf life for being mayor, and for me now, it's been 30 years in elected politics. I've just been blessed by this community. I've been fortunate enough to have started out as a student body president, being elected down the street, and then to be in the state legislature for 16 years, and now to have served as mayor for 12. You really couldn't ask for a better opportunity to repay the city of Bloomington for all it's done for you. But it's also time for, I think, to shake things up, and it's always healthy for a community to have new energy, new ideas. And so I've decided not to run again in 2015.
When did that start to come about for you? When did you start thinking about that?
I started thinking about it in April of this year. And honestly, I started to think about it when the ordinance on the standardized businesses didn't fare so well. I felt like a Democrat mayor with 9 Democrat city council members ought to be able to provide the kind of leadership to protect the uniqueness of downtown. And so when I was unable to protect Kirkwood, the square, and Restaurant Row in the way that I really felt strongly about, although again, I certainly was in the minority opinion there, so I don't mean to say everyone else was wrong, but I felt like it's probably time to have new vision and leadership that can best meet the needs of the community. But everything that I ran for was to protect the uniqueness of Bloomington, and That's why I've been concerned about I-69. I think the homogenization of a community is a dangerous thing, and anything that threatens the distinctness, the quirkiness, people sometimes say. What I loved about Bloomington, the reason I chose to stay here in Bloomington, was how eclectic it is. And I worry as we grow, and we're growing population-wise, geographically, we're growing in size of buildings, that it's important to put measures in place that really protect that uniqueness. And so when I was unable to get that done, I really started to think it might be time for a new vision for what we want for our community. We've done so many good things over the years, and having built the trail, set aside land for the Certified Tech Park, and I hope that Switchyard Park, and probably one that we don't talk about much because it's not very glamorous, but maybe the most important thing we've done is to expand the water treatment plant that will provide, you know, clean drinking water for people for decades to come. And we've made great strides in our public safety, things we've already talked about today. So I'm really proud of what we've done, and we've got, and the hardest part of the decision wasn't the personal part, it's the impact it has on the team we've assembled. I mean, I just have the best cabinet, department heads and staff that you could ask for. And so to the extent that my decision impacts their lives, that makes it a hard, hard decision. Diane Daly, my executive assistant, you know, John Weikart has come and just been such incredibly supportive. And so people who've made life decisions to come to work for the city and I guess for me, you know, that's a hard decision to make for that reason. But I just can't be more appreciative to them and really to the city of Bloomington and for all the opportunities I've had to communicate with those people by way of WTIU and WFIU. It really has meant an awful lot to me. There aren't very many venues now for people to be able to directly communicate with their elected officials, and this has been a blessing, so thank you.
No, thank you, and I was gonna ask if the Beeline was one of your top...
Oh, absolutely.
There's so many.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. you know, for me, the reason I set out to run was to protect the uniqueness of the community, and I always laugh because I think Bob Zalsberg has heard me say this more times than anybody probably cares to, but I wanted to redefine the definition of economic development. That economic development not just be the traditional kind of ribbon cutting sort of things that mayors love to do, but that it also include the arts and culture, and therefore we created Bloomington Entertainment and Arts District. That it include historic preservation, that it includes sustainability, that small business be just as important to us as larger industry that we try to attract to a community, rightly so, and we continue to try to do. But you know, I wanted to make it clear, and that's why the whole motto of my campaigns, and I hope the administrations, have been that quality of life is synonymous with economic vitality. That if you make it a kind of community people want to live, visit, raise their family, retire to, then it's the kind of place that, you know, you want to invest in and live. So it's everything we've done is really part of a larger puzzle, and all these are pieces that we've tried to make. We've still got a lot of work to do, and so will the next administration, but you know, every administration I've been blessed to work with, and know the McCloskey administration really turned the corner on how city government should work, and the Ellis administration, I think, really humanized the way government works. The Fernandez administration really set us off on this course of how important economic development would be, and I hope we've tried to set it up so that quality of life amenities are synonymous with economic vitality. I don't know what the next administration will be, but whatever it is, I hope we're positioning them economically. Our budget is extremely sound, and I hope we've put things in place as building blocks, both the capital things like the Beeline Trail and the park and the tech park, the bead, but I hope also the humanizing qualities about the community and the quality of life amenities that we've created a springboard for the next administration.